I will not go on in details over on things like ghosts and the quantities and the role of ghosts in the quantizations of gauge theory, so string theory. Now, how many of you have seen things like the Fadet-Popov determinant? Okay, very good. So that's the notion I can use, right? So, right, the Fadet-Popov determinant is supposed to help us keep track of sort of how our gauge fixing condition cuts down the gauge freedom. Roughly, it's right. You can think about the gauge freedom as a delta function of some sort, and this delta function is fixing some function of sort of my gauge directions to zero, and if I have an integral like this. This will not give me one, but will give me roughly, the determinant, one of the determinant of the Jacobian of this f of x at the place where I'm gauge fixing. So in the case at hand, we are trying to gauge fix a metric in 2D. And one of the very before even we started worrying about wall symmetry, at the very first step, we wanted to gauge fix it to be of this form, right? Which means, morally speaking, we are trying to insert a delta function of the off-diagonal components of H, which, if you allow me to use holomorphic coordinates, will look like HZZ and HZ bar Z bar, roughly speaking. So we're trying to make sense of how to impose this, how to convert this delta function into something that removes the gauge freedom in a nice way. And the gauge freedom sends If I do an infinitesimal gauge transformation, it's a coordinate transformation, a wave which has to move me away from the flat mat, from this diagonal form, that means that this HZZ will change by something like del Z VZ bar plus del Z. Right, and H z bar, which will change by something like del z bar v of z. All good there. So our delta, the Jacobian that we're trying to discuss here, the analog of the derivative of f with respect of x. Well, here x is the role of x is played by this v. So these are the freedoms to move along the gauge orbits. And the constraint is that this should be zero. So now the analog of this is sort of the del z bar operator is acting on a vector. On a holomorphic vector. And map into something with two lowercase z bar indices. We need to add something to our path integral, which adjusts this, which reproduces this Jacobian. And we do it by adding ghosts. And the ghosts, right, in order to get a sort of a determinant of something, I add some fermions, and I place one of the fermions in front, the other in the back, so that when I integrate over the fermions, I get the determinant. And so roughly, we want to add something that looks like the integral on my surface of B del bar del Z bar C, where this is a C of Z, that plays the role of this V. I'm going to put two Z's here so that this is something I can integrate, plus the complex conjugate. So this thing will have to be added to my scalar fields in order to really reproduce the gauge fixed but integral over the matrix. Here I should have written also the sort of usual square root of H. But another nice feature of this action is that it's also well invariant, like the one for the scalar fields was. I'm not going to go too details, but at the end, the well invariance just sort of factors out and can be thrown away by hands pretty much.
Sorry, can you say one more time? The B and C,
they're
scalar fields?
So C is a fermion, okay, valued, which behaves as a vector. Uh-huh. B is a fermion, which behaves as a traceless true index tensor. Any questions about this? Any other questions? Yes?
Yeah, maybe just to, it's not entirely clear to me why it would have to be, yeah, the index content of the B, the traceless part. What justifies that, those two properties of B?
Pretty much B has the same properties as the constraints you're imposing. So I want to kill BZZ and BZ bar Z bar, and so I put the BZZ and the BZ bar Z bar.
You were about to write two terms for the gauge transformation, which would be, I suppose, the anti-symmetric, like the killing equation, the two terms, and you removed one. I think it was that.
No, they're both terms here. I mean, okay. VZ bar up is the same as VZ down, so.
Okay. And the symmetrized, shouldn't it be symmetrized as well?
No, they're already symmetric.
Okay. Maybe I just can't see it. Okay.
I mean, del 1 V1 is symmetric. I don't need to write the 1 V1 plus the 1 V1.
Okay. Okay.
So, now, how many of you have seen BRST symmetry when you're studying the Fadiev Popov determinant? Okay.
What symmetry?
BRST.
BRST.
Yes. Okay. That's kind of sad that it's typically neglected, but. So when you do the traditional quantization of gauge theories, you introduce the Fadiev Popov determinant. And then if you do a bit more advanced things, you discover that with great surprise that there is kind of a symmetry that is emerged out of nowhere, where you sort of do gauge transformations with parameter C and also have B transform into whatever kind of, well, and into your constraint. So something like this, Q acts on B, and maps it to TAB, the stress tensor, and acts on whatever other fields you had, and as a gauge transformation, which in this case is the diffeomorphism. And there are more other transformations, but I'm not going to discuss the BRST symmetry in detail at all, unfortunately. But a more conceptual understanding of quantization of gauge theories would put these at the front and center. So there is some very beautiful idea called, which can be called derived geometry, where you're trying to study some kind of something like a manifold, which might be complicated, and you embed it into a simpler manifold, which are sort of some extra bosonic directions and some extra fermionic directions. And then you set up a symmetry that guarantees that the extra bosons and the extra fermions cancel out in all calculations, so that you're effectively talking about the original manifold. Okay, so intuitively, I have something like a complicated blob, and I want to insert it in flat space, or something like that. And there are these extra bosonic directions. And sort of I add on top of this a fermionic direction, a Grassmann odd direction, which sort of gives you another transverse direction. And then you add a symmetry which maps one into the other. So in here, right, I'm literally adding some Bs which are mapped to the stress tensor which I wanted to get rid of, because this was the constraint, it was the equations of motion that came from for the metric, which I had to add on top of the equations of motion after a gauge fix. Right, and also a C, which is sort of a partner of the gauge directions. So that makes sure that the gauge directions go away. And the reason this formalism is nice is that it works very well with quantization. So once you have this bigger system with this extra weird fermionic stuff, it's often the case that you can just quantize this bigger system and you still have this odd symmetry. And then you can still define the quantization of the original system as the quantization of the new system modulo sort of this odd symmetry. I'm using this odd symmetry to make sure that everything that you don't want cancels out in the new description. Right, and if the word cohomology means something to you, I can say that sort of the new system is described as a cohomology of the system you care about is described as a cohomology of this Q. But again, if cohomology doesn't mean anything to you, well, this is an invitation to learn cohomology, which is a powerful and useful notion. And once you learn cohomology the proper way, BRST symmetry sort of is a natural generalization. But
would you mind reminding us what cohomology means for those of us who have learned it but are bad with terminology?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I can give a very, very quick introduction to differential forms. So, you have differential forms when you play with this collection of symbols, coordinates on your manifold, and their differentials. And you treat these as bosonic coordinates, and these as fermionic coordinates, meaning that you do things like the x1, the x2, equal to minus the x2, the x1. Okay? So if I have any function of this larger collection of variables, that will look like some function of your bosonic coordinates plus something from with an extra index. Etc. All the way to something like that. So I just decided to do this. I have a manifold, and I want to add these extra things which behave like Fermionic coordinates, and across coordinate patches, transform in the obvious way. So I can use this definition to sort of glue together things on the whole manifold. And if I use this definition, this behaves like a function. This is like something with covariant index, which is called a one form. This is something with two covariant indices anti-symmetrized, which is called a true form, and so on and so forth. Now, the fact that x and dx are similar to each other is encoded in the existence of a nice operation, the differential, which is essentially this differential operator. It has a nice property that if you act twice with this object, you get zero. So it's what I would call an odd, because this is Grassmann odd, nilpotent vector field. And now I can play the following game. I can look at things which are killed by D, and quotient away things that are in the image of D. Yes. Now, what would be the main motivation? This is what's called the cohomology of D. What would be the motivation for doing something like that? Well, it's essentially Stokes' theorem, meaning a nice feature of forms is that they can be integrated without giving a metric, meaning if I have any submanifold inside my manifold, I can integrate a form over this. This, by definition, picks, if this has some dimension little d, and this manifold has a dimension big d, this, by definition, picks the D part here, capital D, yes, which has a bunch of indices. And then combines with it kind of a Jacobian, where these are some coordinates on your submanifold, and then integrates. Okay. The expression is very nice because, you know, coordinate transformations in X cancel out here, coordinate transformation in U cancel out here. So this is well defined, it patches over the whole thing. And Stokes' theorem is the statement that integrating D of F on some gamma is the same as integrating F on the boundary of gamma. Uh, the fact that this square is zero works very well with the statement that the boundary of a boundary is zero. So now you see, so what does it mean that something is killed by D, right? It means that if I integrate it on anything, which is a boundary, I'll get zero. So something in the kernel of D detects integration cycles which cannot be squeezed away. So it keeps has information about your manifold. It knows that there is something of some dimensionality inside my manifold, like, you know, which cannot be contracted away. On the other hand, things that are in the image of D sort of only knows about the boundaries of the manifold. So, which means that, okay, all right. I don't want to spend much time on this, but anyway, sorry. This sort of object, although is defined just in terms of, you know, local things, you know, looking for functions, things that solutions to some differential equation, which, you know, modulo trivial solutions, sort of. It ends up having topological information about the space I'm living in. And morally and practically, what's going on is that these fermionic degrees of freedom are sort of canceling out locally the bosonic degrees of freedom in such a way that everything about the local shape of the manifold goes away, and only global topological information remains. Yes, this is cohomology. Yes, that's right. And what I was trying to say is that in this case it's dual to the homology of homology, which is integration cycles modulo boundaries. No, integration cycles which have no boundary and which are not boundaries or something else. So analogously, in the Bereste description of the quantum field theory, you look at the kernel of Q, modulo the image of Q, in everything you're doing. As long as all your observable states and things you think about live in here, then you're sort of guaranteed that the details of how you gauge fixed and all the subtleties are immaterial. So sort of the fact that the specific form of your gauge fixing doesn't matter is built in. The fact that your gauge degrees of freedom never affect anything physical is built in, and so on. So we're not gonna use this formalism, but I think it's important to mention it. And in the lecture notes, I go in detail on various ways to think about it. It's a powerful tool. Now, in practice, all I need is some very basic information about this theory in order to describe the spectrum of string theory, or bosonic string theory, at least. So whenever we do our calculations now, we'll have to use the Hilbert space for the scalar fields, which we studied previously, and also a little bit of the Hilbert space for the Gausts. But really, we'll only really ever need to use the ground state for the Gauss system.
If you have to study it through the cohomology lens, would our corresponding Hilbert space have Gauss?
Sorry?
If you were to follow the cohomology route to gauge fixing,
yes.
Would our Hilbert space have Gauss?
So you take this Hilbert space with Gauss, and then you look at the cohomology of Q, which in practice does things like make sure that things are gauge invariant and ensure that the constraints are in the image of Q and so decouple from everything. So it makes it possible to make statements like T is zero. In a nice way. So the states we're gonna care about are things like this ground state for the Gauss times the Fock space states that we discussed before. And the only reason we really care about keeping track of this is that actually this contributes to the energy, to the Casimir energy. That's pretty much the only reason. And yeah, so the same way as our ground state had a certain shift in the energy, right? The energy of these states was something like p squared minus 1 over 24 for each individual scalar. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I'm not 12, sure. So. But we only have like a ghost ket. How come we don't have anything for the other Hilbert space?
Oh, here we have a lot of stuff, right? We have all the products of A's and A bars of P for all P's, right? So here, each scalar gave me something like this. And then we can get extra stuff on top if we add with A's, act with A's and E bars. So I need to do something like that, summing over from I equal to 1 to 26, so whatever is the dimension of space-time, which is going to be 26. So I get something like, this is just the momentum as a vector squared. If I define a vector this. And then naively, I would have something like minus 26 over 12, which is horrible. But then when I add in the Gauss, they correct this to p squared minus 2. Okay. And the reason, one of the reasons, well, okay, we'll see why 2, why it's nice that this is an integer and not some crazy fraction. Okay. So, now we have what we need to figure out what the spectrum of string theory is, or bosonic strings is. So I want to describe the physical states inside the Hilbert space of the scalar fields, and so the Hilbert space of the ghosts. Right, I really should take this and do the cohomology of Q, but I'm doing things a bit by hand. And the final result turns out to be the same, although it's a non-trivial theorem. So I'm going to ask for my physical state. I'm going to do something like a Gupta-Bleuler quantization in electromagnetism. So I'm going to say that the modes of the stress tensor kill the physical states, at least the positive modes. And the same with L bar. I'm going to ask the energy that also the zero modes kill it. So the energy and momentum is zero on the worksheet, because these are also modes of the stress tensor. In the notation we introduced last time, this is something as 0 minus 1. And 0 bar minus 1. And also, some of the physical states will be null, meaning I need to throw them away. And these are everything which looks like L minus n acting on something else for positive n. So the definition of physical, so as you remember in Gupta-Bleuler quantization, like quantization, you're trying to impose the constraint equal to zero, like the current equal to zero quantum mechanically. And it's a bit too strong to require that all the modes of the current kill your physical states. Somehow you have something like physical state, and then you have your T and physical state, and you want to guarantee that this is zero. If the positive modes kill the states on the right, then the negative modes will kill the ones on the left because they are joined to the positive modes, and so things will work. If a state is killed by L minus n, is an image of L minus n, L minus n will kill the physical. So if I try to do something like physical null, I'll get zero because L minus n kills the physical state. So I have this collection of states which satisfy the constraint. Inside there are states which are orthogonal to all other states, including themselves. So they are norm zero in particular. So I throw them away. And then I can hope that what's left, physical modulo null, will be a nice Hilbert space with a positive definite inner product. This is not obvious. It's some kind of a no-ghost theorem. In the electromagnetism, for example, it was important that you were in Lorentzian signature. And then if you remember the time-like component of the creation operators was the one that was originally problematic, had some negative norm. And this procedure would get rid of it and left you just oscillators with positive energy corresponding to the transverse modes of the photon. And here, something like that is going to happen. So the name of the game for the rest of this morning is let's look for physical states and throw away null states. So, well, let's start with no oscillators, no A's. So when is these physical. Let's look at the conditions. What happens if I act with L with the destruction operator on this? Any guesses? Remember that the LNs thought there were some. Normal ordered bilinears of A's whose total index is n. And remember the positive modes are destruction operators. So what happens if I act with Ln of this, where n is positive? Yes, yes, that's right. There is no place where this can go. Because if I act with anything, any positive A on it, I get zero. And if N is positive, at least one of these two is positive. So this automatically satisfies all of these conditions. We only need to worry about this condition. Oh, so the ghost, as I said, it's the ghost ground state. So I said this space has a state, the ground state, which is the one, the lowest possible in the Fock space of the ghosts. We don't need to care about the Fock space of the ghosts at all. I'm going to tell you by fiat, these are the states you're looking for. But once you do that, you don't have to worry about this. And the only contribution it gives to L0 to this formula is that instead of having something like minus 26 over 24 here, you have minus 1. So the Casimir energy is corrected to minus 1 by having this ghost ground state. So I need a condition that p square over 2 minus 1 equals to 0. So that p squared is 2. This looks a lot like the on-shell condition for a particle, for a scalar particle. And indeed, the states of the string theory, of the bosonic string, will behave like a scalar of mass squared minus 2.
Mm-hmm. I'm confused about how the same operator can annihilate both the physical state and the ghost state.
This is the tensor product.
Right, but we're acting on them with one A, one like Ln, that's annihilating the whole. Like, I don't understand how it can annihilate simultaneously.
It's a product, not a sum.
So that element is on the left space, sorry.
It's a product, not a sum. So. Let's give a. Yeah.
And we don't really care what happens.
Well, let's give examples of tensor products of Hilbert spaces. Okay? So, for example, suppose that I have quantum mechanics with two positions and two momenta. Okay. Then wave functions are functions of x1 and x2. Examples of wave functions would be a function of x1 times a function of x2.
So annihilating one is enough.
That's right. So if for example, this is 1, it would be annihilated. The whole thing would be annihilated by p1. So here is the same. These are like a function of two variables.
So our definition of ln acts on P.
Yes. So, well, ln will have contributions on the Gauss too. This is actually the total stress tensor. So yes, there will be something else like a B, sum of B, C. But again, this will be, will involve at least, if n is positive, this will involve at least one positive mode. So this part will kill P. This part will kill the Gauss number, the Gauss ground state. So each individual will kill the whole thing. So this collection of states behave like a tachyon scalar field. So I was telling you before that a string behaves like any kind of extended object. It has a collection of internal states, and each internal state looks like a particle. The simplest possible internal state, the ground state of the string, behaves like a tachyonic particle with a very large mass, because, you know, implicitly this is a measuring the units of the tension of the string. So the mass of the tachyon is the order of the scale at which you would actually start seeing that the string is not a particle. Now, the fact that there is a tachyon tells you that the theory of bosonic strings make no sense, sadly. Mm-hmm.
Why do you say that it's static?
Sorry?
No,
I didn't.
Oh, okay.
No, sorry, it's a scalar field. It's a scalar field, and it has a very large negative mass. But let's keep going just for fun. What the next thing we can try? Well, we could try to put a single oscillator but this. Here I change L0 and did not change L0 bar. So it's quite clear that this is not going to work. The two equations in particular tell you that L0 must be equal to L0 bar on physical states. It's called the level matching condition. So if I want to put an A minus 1, I better put also an A bar minus 1. OK? And then, because I have a whole collection of them, I can take some linear combination. So now, what are the constraints? When is this key? Is there any risk that Ln will fail to annihilate them? Which Ln could possibly not annihilate this? Sorry, did somebody say something? No, I thought I heard. So remember, this is an energy that is one above the ground state. So can I lower the energy by 2? That will annihilate it. Automatic. So L2 will annihilate it. L3 will annihilate it, and so on. That's all safe. The only problem is L1. So I need to compute L1 acting on this. And L1 contains A1 and A0. I don't need to worry about the Gauss part because this is the ground state for the Gausses. So this gives me, so A1 kills this, and A0 just gives me the momentum. So the answer here is P mu times A bar nu minus 1 B tensor Ghost. So we learn that epsilon mu nu B P mu should be 0. And also epsilon mu nu P nu should be 0. This kind of looks like a transversality condition in electromagnetism, except that we have two indices, each of which should be orthogonal to P. I also need to worry about null states, things that are in the image of L minus 1. And with a bit of work, you can see that if epsilon is proportional to P, is null. Again, this should remind you of electromagnetism, where, you know, if the polarization is parallel to momentum, that's a null state. The condition that is 0 equal to 1 is very nice, actually, because it tells you that P squared is 0 now, because the minus 1 is already accounted for by this. So these are massless states. They behave like massless particles with some transversality condition where you throw away longitudinal modes. Now, in order to sort of get to the physics a bit better, what you can do is to split epsilon into a symmetric traceless part, an antisymmetric part, and a trace. If you do that, then these conditions for these look a lot like the ones for a graviton. So it's a symmetric, you know, did you look at sort of gravity linearized?
Yeah.
If you look at the linearized Einstein equations, you find a little fluctuation mode, which is symmetric traceless, is transverse to momentum, and such that these are null, a pure gauge. In fact, if these are pure gauge, you can kind of see them. P mu eta nu plus P nu eta mu is just the Fourier transform of a coordinate transformation.
Sorry, what's the eta?
Just anything you want. Any function of P with one index. So here is what made people very excited. There is a massless graviton in bosonic strings. At least there is a massless spin shoe particle. But then you can actually, you know, if you look at properties of massless spin shoe particles in quantum field theory, you realize quickly that they have to be a graviton, like they can only couple in a very specific way to other things in a unitary way. And there's another way to understand why this is really a graviton. We'll get to it in a different lecture.
How hard would it be to detect it?
What does it mean?
I don't know, with a particle detector, you know? Or use cosmology or something.
It's a graviton. The fact that I'm sticking to the ground already detects that there is a graviton.
The massless one predicted by string theory, is it the same as the graviton?
It's a graviton. So
what is the graviton?
Meaning there is only, in quantum field theory, there is only the graviton that is spin shoe massless.
Okay, so
So everything that is Pinchu massless behaves as a graviton, couples to the stress tensor, and there can only be one.
Okay.
So these are very cute theorems that you can derive by looking at soft, you know, soft particles in scattering amplitudes and unitarity.
So it's exciting because it reproduces the graviton.
Yeah, it's exciting that there is a massless graviton. That's right. That's right. It is a tachyon, which is sad, but having a tachyon is a good thing.
Regarding the tachyon,
yes.
why is it negative mass square?
The conventions that were used in defining the action for the scalar field and so on were that most of the directions are space-like. And when you sort of this P squared really meant the square of the space part of the momentum minus the square of the time part. So when you write your action, the integral dA x mu dA x nu, there is mu, this you are contracted with a Lorentz metric. And the scalar, the space directions are nice and they have the correct sign in front to be unitary theory. The time direction has the opposite sign, which means it can give you trouble. It's not unitary. Just as it happens in electromagnetism, when you look at the commutation relations for the field strength, for the gauge connection, the A0 part is the wrong sign commutation relations. And indeed, only after you throw away null states, you get something which is unitary. The same thing is happening here. Right. Now, there is more stuff that is massless in this theory. There is an antisymmetric tensor with two indices. This is very natural in the theory of strings, in the sense that in the same way as a particle is naturally coupled to a gauge connection, which is a one something with one index that you integrate over the world line of the particle, a string is naturally coupled to something with two indices. But we'll get there. And then there is a scalar, massless scalar, the dilaton. And as we'll see, it sort of controls the strength of the coupling between strings. Then after this, if you keep going with analysis, you're going to find more and more complicated. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Sorry, I have a bit of a confusion about this. So we're using the same kind of primary, right, to arrive at tachyons and at gravitons?
Well, I mean, it's, I'm using.
And then we're acting on it with different operators, right?
Well, I'm taking this Hilbert space, or this Fock space of the scalar field theory. And I'm trying to find inside there the physical states of the string theory.
That physical space includes a tachyon.
Hmm?
We're saying that the physical space includes a tachyon.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
So the part, a string which has no excitations turned on, behaves like a tachyonic particle.
I guess I don't understand why it's exciting to find a graviton in a theory that includes.
Well, it really becomes exciting if you find a variant of the theory which does not have the tachyon. Yes, I agree.
The string would not be. Okay. So a string that's not in an excited state behaves as a tachyon, but if it's not in an excited state, does it impact anything, or is it like?
It's like saying I'm studying a proton. A proton has a collection of states it can be in, and the law, like the ground state of the proton, is it happens to have a negative mass squared. And then the first excited state of the proton is a massless particle, and then the next excited state, which maybe will have some a minus 1 squared or some a minus 2 sort of stuff, will actually have p squared equal to 2, minus 2. So it's going to have something with positive mass squared, very massive.
So then if this is the case, like, does that mean, like, is it accepted that this specifically, this theory without any corrections is unphysical, or are there physical interpretations?
So the fact that there is a tachyon means that your loop diagrams will behave poorly in practice. So this is, we're going to define only perturbative string theory. So we're going to define only the perturbation theory, a perturbation theory-like thing, sum over Feynman diagrams.
Okay.
And I can't, if I have a quantum field theory with a tachyon, I can try to study fluctuations around the vacuum on this theory.
You can, you can.
At some point, the loop diagrams start breaking down. The infrared effects are bad, essentially because this tachyon wants to decay to something. And so you cannot make sense of bosonic string, or even perturbatively. When you start the thing, string theory is not bosonic string theory. String theory is a fermionic version of the string theory, where there is extra stuff on the worksheet, and which has no tachyon. It only has these massless fields and then positive things with positive mass squared. And since I was talking about proton, even better would have been to talk about a meson, because a global, because after all, the theory of strings was originally developed to study globals in QCD. And then when people found that, so having a massless global was very bad for people, then they realized it was a graviton, and they thought they could use the theory for something else. Okay. Right, so the picture is this. You get this tachyon scalar, you get these massless modes, and then you get an infinite tower of modes with positive mass squared and increasingly complicated spin, because you start having big collections of these A's and A bars, each of which carries a spin index. At low energy, your string theory will look like a theory of these massless modes and the tachyon and an infinite tower of massive particles of increasing high mass, large mass. Yes?
So is there something inherent to the higher spin or the high mass that makes these, that would make detecting this infinite tower really difficult?
So the physics we see around us is mostly described by the standard model, okay? Meaning that at all energies you can probe, everything works within the standard model. We expect that the standard model is not a complete description, because standard model plus gravity breaks down at high energy. And also because of, I don't know, other things that are a little bit weird in the standard model, like there is a Landau pole, so the strength of electromagnetism also goes bad at high energy. Anyway, we expect that at some point it will be replaced by another theory. Why don't we see the theory? Because the changes will manifest themselves as some, maybe it's only at sufficiently high energy.
So the higher runs of the infinite tower are only really high energy.
Right. So a way to define a string theory is a theory where the UV divergences of gravity are in perturbation theory. So gravity theories of gravity have divergences in perturbation theory. Amplitude start, probability start becoming bigger than one at some point. In a string theory, these problems are resolved in perturbation theory much sooner than the Planck scale. Meaning that also the notion of geometry breaks down much sooner than the Planck scale. So I think there are almost theorems that anything that has this property, that means that it has gravity at low energy, but at some point gravity is replaced by something else, and this happens much sooner than the Planck scale, will have to have sort of infinite towers of particles with high spin, arbitrarily high spin. And string theories are a way to, perturbative string theories are a way to produce such theories with this property, you know, perturbation theories with this property. We will see maybe in one of the next two lectures that string perturbation theory, at each order in perturbation theory, is finite. So UV divergences are gone. Yeah, this is the only thing that I can really say. But right. From that perspective, now that this deciding if our universe is described by a string theory or not, which just requires seeing something that goes beyond the standard model, and then seeing what it looks like. Without experimental input, it's hard to see what happens beyond the standard model. Now, there was at some point a dream of sort of bootstrapping yourself, meaning that perhaps it's so hard to write down a theory which looks like gravity plus stuff at low energy that we can use the power of our minds to figure out what should be going on. And one of the harsh lessons of string theory is that theories that look like gravity at low energy plus stuff are a dime a dozen. At least perturbation theory. We don't have a non-perturbative definition of string theory, so it's not clear which, if any, of these perturbative string theories will be true theories. That's a hard question. But at the very last, I think it put a serious dent into the hope of a theory of everything. Another complication is that the very notion of theory of everything is very particle physics oriented, meaning that it's based on this idea that as you go at shorter and shorter distances, you find things that are more and more primitive, and that knowing what goes at short distances determines what goes at large distances. You know, the notion of RG flow. RG flow is very ingrained in the way we look at the universe. But gravity doesn't seem to care very much about these notions, meaning that there are, you know, hints that large distances or short distances talk in ways which go beyond the RG flow. That's sort of the non-perturbative questions about gravity. that string theory does not answer in directly. Things that are connected to string theory, like holography, might give you insights. But you know, string perturbation theory only gives you the insight that the perturbative problems of gravity can be cured before the Planck scale.
Is there an RG scheme for perturbative string theory as
well? I mean, in perturbation theory, renormalization is part of the very any computation in quantum field theory. And so finite renormalization will be a part of the process in studying a string theory too. The lack of UV divergences means that the finite renormalization does not need to play with infinities and intermediate steps.
Is there still UV IR decoupling assumption?
Well, to the degree that you can talk about geometry, as soon as your energies become of the scale of one in this string perturbation theory, geometry breaks down in very interesting ways. So talking about IR and UV breaks down in a way that is not necessarily the same as it would break down in a generic theory of gravity, because these are special theories where gravity disappears much earlier than the Planck scale. There are other theories that you encounter studying string theory, like M theory, which don't have this property where gravity disappears only at the Planck scale, but we don't understand much how to do calculations with them.
So there we have a linearized our graviton are linearized perturbations. Is that
yes.
The result of the theory being defined perturbatively, or is that just how we consider?
We will see that scattering amplitudes automatically reconstruct the whole nonlinear structure of the gravity action. We're studying scattering amplitudes perturbatively. So nonlinearities are seen by looking at processes which scatter more gravitons.
Intuition on how ghosts can magically appear out of just like considering momentum ghosts. Sorry, how the graviton can appear out of considering these operators acting on momentum plus ghosts.
I'm not sure what to say. So, remember that gauge fixing is not a canonical thing. So this is just telling you how the graviton comes out in this particular gauge fixing scheme.
So choosing a different scheme might not.
They would appear in it. The graviton would still be there. It would appear in a different way. So it's dangerous to sort of give too much meaning to the structure of how something appears in a given scheme.
But somehow this gauge fixing by adding ghosts in such a way leads to this structure
yes.
that we're saying should appear in others, but it just appears nicely.
Yes. So, for example, there are other gauge fixing techniques for string bosonic strings, like the Lightcon gauge, where you, instead of sort of trying to put the metric in a nice form, you just break Lorentz symmetry and say, okay. I parameterize my string by where it is in time and in this direction of space. Like we were saying for the non-relativistic approximation for a particle. You can do it. You can do your quantization. You need to work hard to recover Lorentz invariance. It's a very nice gauge because everything is unitary. There are no ghosts to worry about. It's a very clean gauge fixing. And then the graviton appears in a slightly different way. You don't have this ghost ground state, but you've killed two of the directions so that instead of having 26 over 12, you have 24 over 12. And so you get the same constraints at the end. These indices will now run not from 0 to 26, but from 2 to 26, say. So you just end up with a graviton in an axial gauge. in the light cone gauge, sorry.
You mentioned that we talk about graviton in terms of scattering, so can this describe ground states? Because how can we use this to describe bound states if we are only considering like scattering things, like gravitationally bound states?
Well, what you would do essentially is to write down an effective quantum field theory for the low energy, for which captures all the processes. Like you write down string field theory, and then you would look for you would do whatever you would do in a quantum field theory to answer that question.